Will he or won't he sign the relief bill isn't really the question to be asking. For the tens of millions of Americans at economic risk, the question is, are you kidding me? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 23rd day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to dispense with the president's remarks last night about changes he wants made to the virus relief bill that Congress finally passed on Monday after months of negotiations. We are going to dispense with it with this observation. It's all fun and games and political intrigue until somebody gets hurt. And people are getting hurt all over the place in this economy, as we have been telling you for months. And we got more evidence of that this morning, courtesy of the Commerce Department. We learned consumer spending fell nearly 0.5% last month, the first time it has fallen since April. Think how long ago that was. And at the same time, personal income fell by a little bit more than a full percent, the third decline in 4 months. It's no mystery why, right? Government aid has been keeping people afloat, and that aid is running out. So, to get us going, Marketplace's Samantha Fields looks at what that is going to mean for this economy.
This time of year is normally when people spend more money. Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust, says the fact that personal income and consumer spending dropped in November is a bad omen.
It does give a pretty good sense that households are not going into the new year in very strong shape and adds to the urgency around the negotiations in Washington.
Consumer spending crashed in March and April, but then bounced most of the way back, largely thanks to government aid.
Back in April, after the CARES Act, there was a huge pop in personal income.
Ted Rossman is an industry analyst at creditcards.com.
And a lot of that did trickle down to other sectors of the economy.
He says over the summer, a lot of people felt like things were getting better. But now,
maybe those unemployment checks have dried up. They've long since spent their first stimulus check. Maybe they're not able to go back to work.
And people are nervous after months of uncertainty over whether the federal government would provide more relief, says Tim Quinlan, senior economist at Wells Fargo.
It takes a long time to build up consumer confidence and not so long to disrupt it or to shake it.
And when people have less confidence and income, they're less likely to spend their money. Carl Tannenbaum at Northern Trust says that is a bad combination.
The spending done by households accounts for almost 70% of our annual gross domestic product, our national income.
And if it's not recovering, he says, neither will the economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
One more thing about the will he or won't he sign the relief bill question, which is, again, the wrong question to ask. A better question that might reasonably be asked, since government funding runs out on December 28th, if he doesn't sign it, what's the plan for this economy if the government shuts down in the middle of a pandemic? Wall Street today basically ignored the president of the United States. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In that relief bill, which, I don't know, I mean, he's probably going to sign, right? There is money for a whole new tranche of Paycheck Protection Program loans. You will remember, though, that the first round of PPP money didn't roll out all that smoothly. So Marketplace's Justin Ho, who has been on this story from the very beginning, talked to some small business owners about the pros and cons of applying all over again.
The new Paycheck Protection Program that Congress is proposing would allow restaurants and hospitality businesses to take out bigger loans. Mark Fryer owns 3 restaurants in Vermont. He says he'd like to spend more on supporting his staff during the difficult, colder months.
We're running in a deficit right now just to even try to remain open and keep our employees on payroll.
Congress's proposal would also make it easier for smaller loan borrowers to apply for forgiveness. Sophie Blake owns a jewelry store in Virginia. She says it was a struggle to apply for her $14,000 PPP loan.
There were about 20 to 30 pieces of documentation I had to submit and I'm still waiting to hear back whether I'm going to get forgiven or not.
Blake says her jewelry sales have been slow this holiday season, which is usually one of her busiest times. And next year, her rent is going up. She says if her PPP loan isn't forgiven, she probably won't apply for another one.
I don't think I want to take on any more debt. You know, I already feel anxious with the debt that we have.
Some PPP recipients aren't sure they need this second go-around. Jackie London is a public health consultant based in Colorado.
After the disastrous quarter two in the spring, I'm in a better position at the end of the year. And so I'm not sure, to be honest. Right now, I'm leaning towards no.
London says she'd like to think that by holding back, business owners who need a loan more than she does will have a better chance. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If they do decide to apply for new PPP loans, those are for smaller businesses, or if they get other kinds of government help for bigger companies, we could be looking at workers who've been furloughed over the past 9 months being brought back. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, after all that time that some people have been on furlough, bringing them back might be harder than people think.
When employers are ready to rehire, there are lots of options because...
Right now, there's just so many people are looking for work.
Says Lauren Rivera, professor at Northwestern University. So Wharton professor Peter Capelli says companies might wonder...
Why shouldn't we use this opportunity to look around a little bit and see if there's somebody we would rather have? You know, it's been almost a year now without having him around.
Legally, employers are free to court other candidates, says Heidi Shearholtz, a labor economist.
For the vast majority of workers, there's no legal right of recall if the employer starts hiring again. The exception to that is for unionized workers.
With hiring rules in their contracts. But for a company bringing on new workers, kind of expensive. Whereas rehiring a worker may mean reissuing equipment and restarting emails. That's still thousands of dollars cheaper than onboarding and training a new employee. And
you don't have to, for example, do reference checks if you already know all about this worker because they were already your worker.
But, says Aaron Hatton, a sociology professor at the University of Buffalo, once furloughed employees are hired back,
those workers may very well harbor ill will and be less likely to commit to go over and beyond the way they may have before.
Right now, says Hatton, workers are in a pretty vulnerable position. And if they get called back, chances are they'll go. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
It makes sense that the first mobilization of corona vaccines started, first of all, with healthcare workers, but also in senior living facilities for residents and staff. But getting those shots where they need to go, in facilities that have been dealing with outbreaks and equipment shortages and labor challenges, is going to be a challenge. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
Michael Hicks is the CEO of Sundale Nursing Home in West Virginia, about 80 miles south of Pittsburgh. He remembers getting a call on March 22nd.
We had the first case of community spread coronavirus in West Virginia. That was a devastating time for us.
He says they've had 94 cases and 5 deaths since then. Hicks had to find gowns, gloves, and masks, but couldn't get everything he needed from his usual medical supplier.
A lot of the N95 masks have been coming from the National Guard, so they've been a tremendous support for facilities in West Virginia.
A recent study by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group found nursing homes across the country have struggled to find enough PPE, and that shortages actually worsened by fall. About 2/3 of nursing homes are currently operating at a loss, according to the National Center for Assisted Living, a trade group. Executive Director Scott Tittle says staffing has been the top COVID-related cost for the battered industry.
If you can imagine just the sheer stress, the long hours, you know, the intensity level of what our frontline staff, really heroes, have gone through over the last 9 or so months, it's just incredible. And so we know that labor will be a significant challenge in the future.
The vaccine could be a ray of hope. Lisa Gaudette is the vice president of business development and marketing for Berkshire Healthcare Systems in Massachusetts.
It's like Christmas morning to a certain extent. There is a tremendous amount of relief, excitement.
Vaccinations will start soon at Berkshire's network of 20 facilities. 55 residents died after outbreaks at two of its nursing homes.
We are, you know, at the beginning of the end of what has been a nightmarish experience.
The vaccine will be given to residents and staff by workers from pharmacy chains like CVS. But Dr. Michael Barnett from the Harvard School of Public Health says one major issue is,
how can you get consent for a vaccine from nursing home residents who aren't able to really offer informed consent on their own because they have dementia or they have some kind of cognitive impairment that prevents them from doing that?
That's something Sundale in West Virginia has already experienced. Here's CEO Michael Hicks again.
With the Pfizer vaccine, once you've taken it out of the ultra cold storage, it has to be used within 5 days. So it was shipped into West Virginia last Monday. Those vaccines had to be used on Friday.
Except Sundale wasn't able to get consent in time for about a dozen of their residents. So they missed the window for that shipment. Ultimately, Hicks says he scrambled and was able to find doses at another pharmacy and get most of the remaining residents vaccinated, except two who flat out refused. And that is another hurdle in the vaccination effort. Residents and some staff who don't want to get vaccinated. Michael Barnett from Harvard again.
Nursing home workers tend to be disproportionately minorities, and they are in a group that has a high rate of concern about the vaccine.
Experts say the history of abuse between the medical establishment and Black and Latinx communities will be a challenge for public health officials. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has said employers can bar unvaccinated employees from the workplace. Hicks says he's not worried about having to do that. Gaudette at Berkshire says for now, they are working with their staff who have hesitations.
There's a certain percentage that I think they're just not comfortable. They're skeptical.
Lana Hoover, a retired teacher outside of Fort Worth, Texas, placed her parents in a nursing home in March. She wasn't able to see them in person for 7 months, though by the time her father died in November, she was able to be by his side. She says a lot of the damage done by the pandemic won't be solved by a vaccine.
What I hear from most friends who have parents in a facility or a community like that is they are seeing them all go downhill much more rapidly, as did my parents. And I truly think that's from loneliness. I'm much more concerned about loneliness than I am COVID.
She's still eager to get her mom vaccinated as soon as possible. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up,
spending a lot of money to keep my new dog fed and entertained.
Oh, yeah. Dogs will get you. First, though, let's do the numbers. I love dogs. Dow Industrials, up 114 points, 0.3%, 30,129. The NASDAQ, down 36 points, about 0.2%, 12,771. S&P 500, basically flat, closed at 36.90. A follow-up to Sam Fields here, that Commerce Department data that she was talking about. It shows consumers cut spending on things like dining, also big-ticket purchases like cars and appliances. Banks were buoyant, still shored up by a recent move by the Federal Reserve. It let the banks it supervises resume corporate share buybacks following some stress tests. Thus, JPMorgan Chase up 2.7%. Bank of America rallied 2.8%. Today, Wells Fargo up 4.7%. Bond prices, well, thanks for asking. They fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.94%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Don't ask, don't tell ended as the official policy about lesbian, gay, and bisexual people in the military in 2011. For LGBTQ veterans who served before that, though, their civilian lives since leaving the service have been complicated, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
For the 12 years she was in the Navy, LaWanda Mobley says she was pretty much the ideal service member.
I had a stellar career. I had medals. My performance evaluations were always the highest marks that you could receive. Everybody spoke highly of me.
She was also a lesbian in the military, and because of that, says she was the victim of sexual harassment. And then, on one of her deployments, Mobley tested positive for drugs.
Because of the things that happened, and I self-medicated, that ultimately is what led to my discharge. And my sexual orientation definitely played a role.
Once she left the military, that set off a spiral.
Basically, I was unleashed on society with an addiction, and that led to a life of drug use and drinking for the next 13, 14 years.
Mobley eventually got sober and realized she'd left a lot of veterans' benefits on the table. She's now getting them and works for the Veterans Administration, but many LGBTQ veterans are still missing out. They can't get VA home loans or financial aid for higher education because they didn't receive honorable discharges. Jennifer Dane is with the Modern Military Association of America, which represents LGBTQ service members and veterans.
There's about 114,000 veterans that were discharged either other than honorably or dishonorably because of just simply by being LGBT and trying to serve in the military under discriminatory policies.
Veterans who were denied benefits because of their sexual orientation can apply to the Department of Defense to have their discharges upgraded. Dane's group helps them navigate the process. She says requests are up nearly 75% since the start of the pandemic.
Because they don't have access to the VA healthcare. They don't have access to, you know, even if they want to go back to school, they can't do that because they don't have access to the GI Bill.
And it can be tough to get a job with anything other than an honorable discharge. Many civilians don't understand the difference between a dishonorable discharge and the other than honorable discharge many LGBTQ vets received. Ashton Stewart runs the SAGE Vets program, which focuses on older LGBTQ New Yorkers who served.
One of the veterans that we're talking to told me a scenario that he was applying for a job, things were going great. They had a really friendly hiring program for veterans.
Then the employer asked to see that veteran's discharge papers, which showed he'd received an other than honorable discharge for his sexual orientation.
And they told him to his face that we would hire you on the spot, but we just can't take that risk.
The VA website says upgrading a discharge can take a year, but Jennifer Dane at the Modern Military Association says there's a backlog.
We are lucky if we see any changes within 2 years, and we're lucky if we get that. Sometimes we get it within 18 months, and sometimes it's 3 or 4 years.
The Department of Defense wouldn't make anyone available for an interview for this story and did not respond to our specific questions. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A lot of material that goes into all the decorations you see this time of year. The Christmas wreaths and the garlands, the potted evergreens. It comes from the Northwoods of Minnesota and a thriving cottage industry there of harvesters and distributors. But as the market for holiday greenery has grown, so too has the opportunity for spruce thieves looking to make a quick buck. Here's Dan Crocker from Minnesota Public Radio.
Just get in here and take a look.
Shane Zavotnik is tromping through a snowy bog in northeastern Minnesota. He's a conservation officer for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This bog is a crime scene. It's covered with young black spruce trees, many with their tops chopped off.
They're cutting in a way that's really hard to detect.
Every few feet, he points out another decapitated tree. It turns out the tops of these small spruce are all the rage for home holiday decorating, and thieves know it.
They want to get, you know, a nice decorative tip. The people that are doing this are really good. You know, they don't have to take a tape measure. They know the 2 or 3 footers, and they're lopping them off with their brush cutters or their saws.
Tree tips are used as tabletop decorations or in pots of greenery displayed on suburban front porches. But this year, many suppliers from Canada haven't been able to sell across the border because of the pandemic. So spruce thieves have stepped in to fill the gap.
So yeah, this is the facility where we keep the seized spruce tops and Obviously, it smells like Christmas in here.
Zavotnik points to a pile of 1,300 spruce tops he recently confiscated from someone who cut them illegally on private land without a permit.
On any given night, two people in a 7 to 8 hour period can cut roughly 1,000 tops.
The stolen tops can sell for as much as a buck apiece to unlicensed buyers. So far this season, conservation officers have seized well over 15,000 spruce tops. They say that's the most they've ever confiscated in a year. But still, it's a tiny fraction of the overall market. The state estimates that holiday greenery, including spruce tops, birch poles, and balsam boughs that are used to make wreaths, is a $23 million industry. So the cost of the thefts?
It's a rounding error. It doesn't even register.
Sean Timonen co-owns a small family business called Black Spruce Holdings. This fall, with his dad, his brother, and a couple dozen crew members, they cut over 1 million spruce tops from state and federal forests and private land. That's enough to fill about 50 big refrigerated trucks. Timonen is an investment guy. He started the spruce top business 20 years ago as a side hustle. Now the Timonens sell to commercial greenhouses, which use the spruce tops to make decorative holiday pots that are sold nationwide.
In our largest account, took over 400,000 tops. That's many, many pots that are being made, again, to these retail chains across the country.
The DIY market is also booming, spurred on by social media like Pinterest and Instagram. A lot of people wonder if cutting off the tops hurts the spruce trees. But Kristen Bergstrand with the Minnesota DNR's Forestry Division says it won't if it's done correctly.
But really what the tree does is throw up a new leader of growth. So it can make the tree not have as good a form.
But it doesn't harm the tree. And in 5 to 10 years, the treetop can be harvested again. In northeastern Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Sam was talking about consumer spending up at the top of the program and how it fell last month, which is, regular listeners will know, concerning since this is a consumer spending-driven economy. So we have gotten a couple of our regulars back on the phone to hear what they have been spending their money on.
I'm Laura Judson, and I live on Isle of Palms in South Carolina. I have to admit, I don't enjoy the commercial aspect of Christmas, and my family doesn't do a gift exchange. As a retired school librarian, I know many educators who try to make the holiday season fun for school children. It gives me great pleasure to shop for books and games to give to them.
This is Kelly Koletsky from Columbus, Ohio. Prices have definitely gone up, especially with meat, but I more than make up for that because my discretionary spending has been really zeroed out. So I take that savings and just, put it towards a grocery store.
Hey, this is Chelsea Lepley from Des Moines, Iowa. Thinking about what my spending habits have been like lately, there have been a lot of charitable donations to homeless shelters, rent relief efforts, eviction prevention funds, supply drives, disaster relief efforts. Spending a lot of money to keep my new dog fed and entertained, and a surprising number of things I didn't know I needed until Instagram's very smart algorithm told me I did.
Gotta love those algorithms. Laura Judson in Isle of Palms, South Carolina started us off. Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio. Chelsea Lepley in Des Moines, Iowa. Final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that I'm getting out of here for about a week and a half, and I hope all y'all can take at least some time off over the next couple of days. But there has been something that's been on my mind. We try real hard on this program to be accessible, to take complicated and, yeah, sometimes boring business and economic stories and break them down so that they are understandable and, if we do it right, enjoyable too. But I'm feeling a need to make sure nobody mistakes our approach and our intent for a lack of seriousness. These are perilous times in this country, politically, clearly, economically, definitely. And the downside risks on both of those are huge. And it's important to me that you know that we know that. All right, we got to go. I'm a little jammed today because I wrote too long. So you got to find your own moment of economic context. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They, of course, are coming into the studios, so the rest of us don't have to, unless, for the love of Pete, your home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.